This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio, now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 85 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where tonight we do a little sleight of hand. We roll our R's in a dramatically Scottish sense, and then we opt to spend the remainder of the episode pulling random bits and bobs out of our pockets until someone tells us that this was actually our last episode, and we just go into cryo sleep for 7 years, if we're lucky. So, here in the GPR studios this evening, my name is Keir. Joined with me, as always, is Jay. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Very good, sir. And joining us once again, our latest addition to the Intrepid GPR crew, Haley is in the house. Haley, how are you?
I'm doing great.
All right. We are continuing to plow through our revisitations of our regenerations and taking a look at what we consider to be the top shelf performances from each of the doctors along the last 50 years. We have let ourselves into what constituted the first rather unexpected official break in the Whovian timeline when a gentleman stepped in to take over the title and kind of tone down the bluster and the wardrobe from Colin Baker for the seventh titular role. So Sylvester McCoy was actually brought in 1984. 87 or so to be the replacement for Baker, not knowing at the time who was going to be there. They were in the middle of a series break. So writers had no idea where they were going to be going with it. Executive producers had no idea where they were going to run with it. And ended up having to actually bring him on, unrehearsed and unscripted. And the writers had to scramble to get some material together, which gave the 24th series a rather rocky start.
A little bit, yeah.
You take that combined with the fact that as a result of some of the confusion that came about from Trial of the Time Lord and where Colin Baker was ending up with that performance, and that very kind of jagged script, I guess you could say, because of all of the things that were going on behind the scenes and the writing, you end up with kind of some rough ground. And we wanted to see whether or not we could explain how it was that through some very careful writing and McCoy's performances and those of his companions were able to actually turn the show around and give it another 3 years of life. So to get a little bit of a backstory here, bear in mind that as we were talking about, Jay and I had mentioned we were talking about Colin Baker, there were some things going on behind the scenes in the form of what was going on with John Nathan Turner as the executive producer. Didn't really have a showrunner role per se, as we would recognize it in productions today. There was actually a pretty clean break between your producer staff and your script writers and story writers, sort of three distinct pieces of the puzzle there. Mm-hmm. But as a result of some issues that were going on with John Nathan Turner, who did not want to be on for Series 24, he planned on walking at the end of McCoy's era. The end of Colin Baker's era. Yeah. Since they didn't have anyone to take over, he sort of reluctantly came along with it and kind of, well, he wasn't trying to do it in, but he definitely wasn't doing it a service. So some rough scripts and a kind of a battered reputation gave the first year for Series 24 kind of a rough go. And one of the only reasons why it was even still on the air in the United States at the time was because of donations from PBS viewers. They would have dropped it from there because they saw that they was having enough of an issue on the UK side of things. And why do they even want to, you know, continue to air it? They had been using a block of Third Doctor episodes, and then they commissioned a sizable chunk of Tom Baker episodes that they were just running on a rotation, not even in order.
Yeah.
So you had viewers not being able to make any sense of what the hell they were seeing. So it was a very rough time for Whovians at this point. But by the time we get to series 25, you know, they just pull things through for 24. You know, they start to see an uptick by the close of that season. Series 25, you've got a gentleman by the name of Andrew Cartmell who steps in, goes from being a story writer to being a script writer and primary script editor. And he decided he was going to take a little bit of literary control over the characters. And he, you know, being an admitted long-term classic Whovian, he wanted to bring the Doctor back to a sort of a more mysterious and kind of a darker character. We talked about this, Jay. I know he had said something along the lines of, and you can kind of run with this. He said, the more you know about the Doctor's backstory, the less mystique that he may carry. I'm paraphrasing here, but it was just, you know, right. The idea of, he wanted to make him mysterious and potent again by taking away too much of an understanding of where he was coming from, literally, and just in some of his justifications for his decisions and the things that he says and does.
Yeah, I mean, and this was a very big departure from what we had seen previously, and a lot of the stories had a much darker tone. One of the stories that we saw tonight, I mean, things get rather graphic for a, you know, family, show. Mm. So it did take a very dramatic turn, not only in the portrayal, but just in the stories and the visual representation as well. So they were really trying to do anything they could to keep the show going. And, you know, obviously things weren't working the way they were. So they just tried to do a complete 180 and, you know, some of that stuff did work, but then the other stuff, you know, worked against it. So,
mm-hmm. I think he had, I'm referring to Cartmell here, had said that in one of the ways that he, if you wanted to keep the Doctor to go back to this sort of a benevolent overseer, you know, have him intrinsically involved in things, get away from some of the political elements that had been sort of intrinsic with Colin Baker. They started doing, you know, so much back on Gallifrey, dealing with councils and things of that sort. Take Trial and Time Lord was indicative of that. But if he was going to drop the veil over the Doctor again and make him more of this strange traveler that his unpredictability was part of his appeal, well, you still wanted something that was a good story construct. And so he decided to latch on to the companions in that case. And I think that's really, you know, as we were just talking before we started recording, that's, I think, what really carries what we recognize as the Seventh Doctor's era.
Right. And I mean, that's something that has carried New Who as well. I mean, that really is the story that we see in the New Doctor stories where, you know, I mean, we all want to see the Doctor and what kind of awesome stuff he does, but clearly this is a story told through the eyes of the companion.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Back to the idea of them being the viewer's link to this fantastic world.
Exactly. Okay. So, Haley, I've got a question. I mean, you're fairly new to Classic Who. You're pretty versed in the New Who, but this is really your first foray into the classic stuff, right?
I've seen the first dozen or so Hartnell episodes, but for the most part, yeah, this is
okay.
The start for me.
So how does this strike you without knowing any of the backstory, any of the behind-the-scenes stuff that was going on with Baker and McCoy and everything like that? I mean, this was a messy time to where Colin Baker didn't even come back to film his regeneration scene. You know, it was all McCoy in a curly blonde wig. So things were really messed up at that time. How does this strike someone who doesn't know anything beyond the curtain?
I mean, I just saw, you know, the few episodes that we picked for this podcast, and for the most part, it seemed kind of confusing and messy as far as the stories went.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's definitely valid. I mean, especially in kind of in the order that we started getting presented with them. You take some of the aspects of what we know Classic Who episode or Classic Who stories typically carry. You know, they're never just a single thread. You know, you've got to have, you know, at least your A, B, and C storylines running. You're definitely going to have your primary villain, but you're probably going to have some secondaries, or at least some lead henchmen or something of that sort that are just as much of right bastards as the ones that they work for. So they try to multi-tier these things. I think when you start getting around to the mid to late 80s here, and the fact that they were trying to do all they could to recover from some of these more stumbling points in the previous series, they started kind of spitballing quite a bit. And I would imagine that by the time we get to, like, the first one that we chose for tonight, which is the close of season 24, it's the finale for that one that ended up broadcasting in late 87, the episode for Dragonfire, is one where if you take it on the surface level, and especially if you know some of the backstory, you can say, all right, I see where they're leading into this. But if you were to drop someone cold into it, like we just did with Haley, I can see Thanks, this guys. Definitely. Well, there you go. Deep end. It's got to be a lot to kind of process. Not to mention the fact that, you know, you've got new characters being introduced and other ones being pulled away without really knowing the significance of why that should stand out. So hopefully we can kind of dissect this here. So we're dealing with an off world and way off time setting here. We're somewhere like 2 million years in the future. Yeah, just a nice round number. Yeah. On this ice world. So for those who were with us through the Trial of Time Lord, you're going to recognize that Glitz is back.
Yay!
In all of his less than reputable. Goodness. I think he grew his sideburns back in, though, so he doesn't have those weird slashes anymore.
No, he's still got the stripes in there.
They were.
How are we going to recognize him if he doesn't have the stripes and the sideburns? I mean, come on.
No, of course not. Yeah. And Doctor's traveling with Mel. At this point, they've got their rapport established. They had gotten a chance to run this entire season together. And Bonnie Langford as Mel is definitely entertaining. I mean, she's got a lot of energy, and she's learned enough from her travels with the Doctor over the previous six stories to know that he does not always have things well in hand.
Right.
So she's always wary about this sort of thing.
Yeah, but I've got to say, at least she wasn't screaming through the entirety of this, because, I mean, the woman's got some lungs on her.
Yes.
We've become well aware of that, and finally she's not exercising that right. And because that was
she
brutal.
Does, not to say she doesn't get her opportunity.
Yeah.
Because
it
definitely comes. But, you know, we get spared. It's not like Mark of the Rani where it was just a, you know.
Constant.
A rat in a trap squealing. But we also get our introduction to Dorothy, Ace.
Right.
Which is pivotal. I think is one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that this one was included, because if I were to look at anything about the run of Sylvester McCoy here, it's the way that he brings along his truest companion through these next couple of years, and the journey that she goes through under his tutelage, literally tutelage.
Yeah.
Keeps referring to him as the professor from like moment one.
Yeah. No, I mean, this was a great story for, you know, laying the groundwork for Ace, and not really, they weren't beating you over the head with the fact that she was going to be the new companion. She could have just been easily been a one-off character with a tremendous backstory. So it wasn't like, hey, look, this is the one the Doctor's going to take soon. Pay attention to her. It was just, they built her as a complete character.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the advantages, you know, if you were familiar with the fact of who Ace was, but you're also understanding in retrospect, we've had instances where we've met companions before they've become companions, you know, and they would kind of traipse through an episode and you wouldn't see them again for a little while longer. And then when they came around again, then they start getting brought on board. It was not something that was originally done, you know, with Clara and that sort of thing. And it goes back a ways. But this was, I think this was kind of well executed. You know, she's got this strange element to her past that we're only getting bits and pieces of. There's no reason why she should be there in the first place. You know, she's a 20th century kid from Perivale who's somewhere millions of years in the future, you know, working as a waitress. you know, hates her job and such. It's just this bizarre scenario, and we get very little explanation about it. But we are getting increasing awareness that it has some importance. So we get invested in her by the time this story ends.
Yeah.
And it only seems right that the doctor brings her along so that we can get more of that.
Yeah. I mean, it did seem really interesting that they, instead of pairing off Mel or pairing off Ace and the doctor, they paired off Mel and Ace. So you've got the exiting companion spending the entirety of the story running around with the new companion.
Right.
And it was just, they worked well together. I mean, I found the two of them together were fun.
I agree. I mean, you would call it kind of a passing of the baton. But we, as you mentioned, we weren't really aware of the fact that this transition was going to be taking place. In fact, Mel's exit makes no sense.
Yeah, no, it was very abrupt and just kind of like, what? Wait, what? Why? I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just going to get off at this stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had enough of these crazy adventures. Oh, but I'm going to go off with that right bastard and have some crazy adventures with him. You come to find out, actually, through some of the extended content that in a couple of the books that follow, that she ends up traveling around with Glitz for about 6 months. Huh. And then she finally has had enough of trying to keep him under control, and she goes off on her own to search for Earth again. So there you go. Not happy times in the Nosferatu 2.
Yeah. Yeah. So...
But you were mentioning about things that were, as far as, you know, going a little darker with these things. I mean, Kane as a villain, an interesting premise to have somebody who's so hell-bent on revenge, only to come to find out that there is no way for him to be able to enact that revenge at the end, but still gets his comeuppance in a rather grotesque way.
Yeah. I mean, so basically the doctor tells him that, hey, your planet's no longer there. It's been 2,000 years since you've been able to exact your revenge. There's nothing you can do. So he basically just opens the window direct into the sun and pulls a very nasty melting scene.
Yeah.
Like a Nazi looking at the Ark.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking too. It was very Indiana Jones.
It was exactly the same technique they used too. They used the layered waxwork over the skull and did it on a sped time lapse.
Yeah.
But they actually, unlike Raiders, they left out the red wax because they didn't want it to be bloody. They figured that would have pushed it too far for the audience.
I think it may have been too far as it was.
As the eyes start to roll down the cheekbones. Yeah, it's okay, kids.
Yeah.
Good night.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
Exactly.
See that dot in the distance? Yeah, that was it.
I mean, I found Kane the more I thought about it, the more I realized this is Mr. Freeze. That's all he's hell-bent on revenge. He's obsessed with this woman who is, for all intents and purposes, dead, you know, to the point of erecting monuments for her. I mean, this is Mr. Freeze from Batman completely without the only thing is that he has to sleep in a coffin every few hours instead of wearing a suit 24/7.
But I think Edward Peele did a good job of carrying Kane as a, you know, as your sinister soul. Mm-hmm. And you definitely buy his seething hatred, misdirected or non-directed as it could be. But I will give them credit for not going the route of actually frosting his hair silver or giving him the big icy eyebrows or any of those kind of shticks.
Right.
They toned back on this one.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely a creepy villain, and he was one that you just wanted to see fail because he was just complete evil. But as the premise goes, it was just a little bit flat for me. But,
okay.
All right, was anyone else waiting for the moment after the Nosferatu blew up and Glitz realizes that it was Kane that did it, and he just kind of goes, Kane. I was wanting the full bore. Kane!
It did seem a little subtle. I'm not sure. That interesting choice there.
I don't know if it would have been too over the top, but I was wanting the whole William Shatner thing going.
Or at least just grit your teeth and shake your fist. Kane!
Just drag it out something, yeah.
You blew it up!
Well, and then we get to progress a bit into what is considered to be one of McCoy's best episodes in terms of overall sort of meta reviews out there, and this is actually the one that you can get your hands on the Classic Who from the Netflix offerings, and that's Curse of Fenric.
Yeah, I mean this one is pretty interesting. I mean it starts off like World War II era. You see a lot of things going on, some Germans approaching in fog and things like that, and then switching over to perfectly accented British English. I found that kind of funny.
Yeah. This is, as Haley was saying about the confusion factor in some of these, this has got enough going on in it where I know when I first saw it, I had to go back and watch the first episode twice to make sure I wasn't
missing.
Yeah, I kind
of missed the point where they brought in the Russians and got rid of the Nazis. I think I missed something somewhere.
Yeah, so when you've got a wardrobe department that is handing you two periods that look a little similar, and you're not getting the fact that you're jumping from one side to the other. So you've got Viking warships, cursed Viking warships, alien artifacts, dead Nazis, Russians under mind control, vampires, and Ace. Yeah, there's a lot going on there. But somehow, through this bizarre start, when it really gets rolling, when you start to see what's going on to the two girls who are slowly succumbing to the curse, as you'll call it, and we start realizing, you know, what these mislabeled vampires really are, it starts becoming a more and more engaging story. Me personally, as you start to step aside and start looking at, again, you know, I know I'm kind of focusing on this, but you start to get this strange drop in about Ace finding out about her grandmother and mother. Now it becomes something entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a really engaging story about that while all of this other phenomenon is going on. I mean, you get to see she's got the whole deal with the code breaking, which I think is an interesting premise. It's something that, yes, I know that Who goes back to, you know, the World Wars every once in a while because it makes for, you know, a nice touchstone for their viewing audience. But this was kind of an interesting of way of being able to combine, you know, what we knew of the war history along with a little bit of, you know, funky Whovian alien pseudoscience. I personally really enjoyed it by the time it really got rolling.
Yeah, the bit with Ace and her mom and grandmother and everything, that was really interesting once you know Ace's story. This was the first Seventh Doctor story that I came across, and it was a little bit weird. I mean, you're like, wow, that just seems really crammed in there. And I mean, you could tell that it was, that there was more to it, but when this is your first introduction to the character, As a lot of people I know it have come across this because it is the one that's on Netflix. It does seem just really shoehorned in there because you don't get anything else beyond that.
Right. So you wouldn't get a good understanding of exactly what her timeline is, where her point of origin is, because she pops right out ready for period.
Yeah.
You know, and ready to be able to play into it. And then you come to realize, well, okay, well, she's not from this timeline. She's a 20th century kid. Okay. She's a 20th century kid, but she's got knowledge of things that are way beyond what she should have. Yeah. This is not one that could really get a lot of viewers dropped into.
Yeah.
I think you may be really well served by grabbing something like Dragonfire first.
Yeah. Haley, what was your take on this whole story?
The first part, I was confused pretty much the entire time, but by the second part, I was kind of starting to follow it a little better, and I thought it was fun. A good, you know, Doctor adventure to go on.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a question, though. Up to this point, had there been more, like, backstory on Ace, like, figuring out what happened with her parents and stuff?
There had been, it's one of the things they would use as their running thread was whenever confronted, she would just claim that she didn't have a family. And that was her cover. It was just a matter of her defense mechanism. And it was brought up in a couple of stories, but it was always one where we never actually started to get any of these things other than the fact that you could tell she was visibly troubled by even bringing the topic up. And no discussion of any other family members beyond that. So that's when they start dropping these sort of things in, and then you realize, okay, well, there's more to it. She doesn't even understand some of the story behind all of it, which makes it even more entertaining for the viewing audience, because now they get to be put in one of those positions where the character that they're following knows no more than they do. So any information, any reveals that you get are something that you get to watch the character go through as well as the audience. So I think that was a very conscious effort.
Yeah, up to this point, they had kept her really, really ambiguous in the terms of family, just so that it became its own mystery. So you were constantly wanting to find out more, but never really getting anything until this point. And you're like, holy crap, what does this mean? And you still don't get any answers, really, but...
Right. And it would end up driving the characters together. You would end up with the benevolence of the doctor in serving not only as a protector and as an educator, but also having to step in as that paternal figure. So there was no way that you could look past the sheltering nature between Doctor and Ace.
Yeah. So the next story that we went with, it's actually the a sad note on it, the final episode that we got from Classic Who, which was Survival.
Yeah, at which the decisions, there was no official decision to say that this was going to be the last story that was filmed, but there was no reassurance that the show was going to be carried farther. So you had a number of people working on the productions that were in various states of knowledge. As a result, you could tell that there were certain aspects from the production teams in terms of some of the, maybe not necessarily from the makeup crew. Sorry, cheetah people. but just in terms of the way some of it was shot, some of the editing work, some of the scoring for the film, strange use of like flamenco guitars and things like that. It was really kind of an odd piece in general, but as far as script material, I think this is definitely, if they didn't know that this was going to be their swan song and that they were going to end up being put into stasis for 7+ years, then this was a really interesting coincidence, because they tried to hit a lot of points on this one.
And I mean, the irony being that the entire theme of the show was pretty much, you know, survival of the fittest. You have to fight to stay alive, and, you know, things are going to kill you unless you absolutely try and destroy them yourself, and this whole thing. And then you find out that it's the end of the show. It's like, oh, guess you didn't fight well enough then, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. From the time the story first opens up, you can tell that there's been a great shift as far as Ace's character. I mean, she looks older. She's got her hair down. They're dressing her more maturely and things like that. She's carrying all of this confidence that however long in program time she's been traveling with the doctor, this confidence has been instilled, and she's carrying it more so. It's not just, she's always been, you know, jump first, look second, but now she's doing so from a far more educated and capable standpoint. She's a stronger character all around, and it's great to see. You know, people keep saying that Rose was this wonderful opportunity of having a companion character that was a positive and strong female role model for female viewers. This, as far as I'm concerned, Ace was that long before they decided to go that route. And it's interesting, if you ever get the opportunity, if you want to get a hold on this one, you're going to be getting it on the DVD set, and it comes along with a number of documentaries. Obviously, a lot of them looking at the fact that this was, you know, last episode before the break and all. But there's a 10-minute piece on the second disc of the set that they actually call Little Girl Lost. And it just follows, it's like this little montage piece that follows Ace's progression. Really kind of interesting to see the way that they break it all down and show how, as she, as Sophie Aldred kind of got her footing within the program itself and really took to Sylvester McCoy personally as an actor's mentor, you see the way her character grows as well. Really kind of interesting stuff.
Yeah, and there have been plenty of times where Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred have appeared at cons and things like that, and they've said that they felt like the redheaded stepchildren, basically. Like, they were given this broken show and said, here, do what you can with it. Yeah, it's not going to last long. And they were constantly having to push the envelope and do things that, you know, you normally wouldn't do under normal circumstances just to try and get another week out of it. And it, they said, you know, it was very trying, but it helped them a lot in growing their character even beyond the stuff that we see on screen, you know, just developing the character themselves and the friendship that they formed in being these sort of renegades, that were trying new things and doing all this stuff, that it really became a bonding moment for both of them. And they're still really strong friends to this day.
Mm-hmm. They do a lot of audio work. Mm-hmm. In fact, Ace's character, as much of an ass kicker as she was on the show itself, when they take her character farther in a lot of the Big Finish productions and some of the extended, not the novelizations, but some of the extended novels that they do within the universe, she gets even rougher and tougher. I mean, because we didn't get to have her exit from this. You know, they walk off at the end of this particular story saying, okay, you know, on to the next one. So, which left the door open for a lot of writers to say, okay, now how much farther do they take with this? And they go even edgier with her down the road. Mm-hmm. And the Doctor having to continue to be the one to rein her back at times in her own best interests, which is just indicative of what McCoy brought to the character. You always kind of got the feel, and I noticed it quite a bit in this one, because this one being so much about life and death situations and how much of yourself are you willing to sacrifice, you know, are you willing to go down to these base instincts in order to ensure your own survival, you know, if you feel that that's what's necessary, or are you the type to be able to try and retain dignity or composure or what have you, even if it means, you know, risking the next breath. So with McCoy, it seems to be this nice microcosm or distillation of the fact that even when he's dealing with his nemesis, I mean, we've got the Master, they're literally at each other's throats by the time that this is wrapping up, planets exploding around them, you know, skies burning and whatnot, and he's still holding back. Because it's a matter of, you know, survival or not, there has to be some sort of a core, an ethical basis to all of this. Yeah. And the dialogue, I think, that Briggs put together is brilliant in order to hit that. Granted, it does not always come across as well as it could, you know, on a written page or something of that sort, because of the way that this episode ended up coming together.
Yeah.
But it's unfortunate because there are some brilliant little soliloquies in here, especially as you get down to those last few minutes.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, this was a lot of fun going back to the Seventh Doctor and seeing some of the stuff, especially with knowledge after the fact. You know, I mean, one thing that Sylvester McCoy has talked about was the fact that he and Sophie Aldred were able to, because things were, you know, the light was blinking in the corner. And a lot of people knew it, that the writers were willing to take a lot of risks and were willing to do pretty much anything because, you know, what's the worst that's going to happen? Your show's going to get canceled. It's going to happen anyway. So they were able to go to the writers and put forth a lot of information into the scripts and say, hey, it would be really great if we tried this. And many of the writers were very receptive to that and saying, oh, yeah, that sounds great. Let's put that in this one. So you have a lot more of the stories being influenced by the actors than we've ever seen previously. Mm.
I think if they had not been able to do that, if they had not had those liberties to take and an opportunity to exercise some of these, you know, I wonder how far we can, or I wonder what would happen if, and being able to handle some of these, you're still dealing with, take what happens to Glitch's ship at the end of Dragonfire. You've got an entire ship being destroyed and the crew lost. You know, we don't have, and we've talked about this a number of times the last few months, we've sort of gotten away in New Who from really allowing the viewers to deal with some of the harder truths. And, yeah. And I don't know necessarily if we want to get into the whole, maybe this is not the time or the place to get into the, you know, Moffat doesn't really kill people discussion, but it's out there. Go ahead and, you know, if you want to just get an earful of it, go out and do a little bit of research out there. And there are people that are very adamant on both sides of these things with decent arguing points. But the show, as we were getting towards this conclusion or this pause in the run of the program, was not holding back from any of those topics. I mean, we were still taking instances of cold-hearted murder. You know, you had genocide was a regular term on the program. You had secondary characters, maybe not always companions, but you had secondary and tertiary characters dying on the show with regularity and frequency. And it was just one of those things where, you know, you started to wonder after a little while, because you watched the impact it would have on the companions, and then you start to think, well, what is this doing to the Doctor? You know, does he just switch these things on and off, or does it weigh on him? And I think with McCoy in particular, because he had that affability, but you could tell that there was a bit of a weariness to it as well, that he had seen enough of it. And he says so in a number of these stories along the way, both the ones we chose and others that are still on the list, like Ghostlight and Battlefield, where you can tell that he's had enough of seeing what different races and species are capable of doing to one another. And he was particularly tired of having to be thrust into this refereeing position. So he'd rather try and, you know, he started wanting to take more of a proactive route and reason people out of these situations before they got escalated, rather than having to save people or deal with the aftermath. So it was a very specific take that they were running with him at this stage.
Right. Well, I mean, the Seventh Doctor gets a lot of flack for being one of the least likable and, yeah, not having the compelling stories and things like that. And he's right up there with the Sixth Doctor when people say the one that I like the least. So it's kind of nice to go back and look at it through the lens of things that were going on at the time and realizing what he had to work with and giving him that benefit of the doubt, basically, of saying, okay, you know, it was a crappy run. He was doing the best he could with it, and just really kind of looking into the things that they really put into the show and not what we got as the finished product. So,
I guess that's probably the majority of it. And the other side of it is, if you're trying to look at it and rank your doctors, and you tend to put Seventh Doctor lower on the list because he doesn't seem to have enough of that, whatever that element is that allows you to feel like this is someone that you can place your trust in, you know, someone that you're going to be right behind their shoulder as you go forward into one of these adventures. I don't think you've seen enough of McCoy's work then.
Yeah.
Because I think that's entirely who he chooses to be, or what he tried to bring to the character was the one who was going to be the protector, but the way he was going about it was not the sense of a fists up or a shouting, you know, we're not going Colin Baker with this one, or even always relying on comedy. I mean, he was definitely one who liked to utilize some comedic elements. Mm-hmm. And he's genuinely entertaining in that regard. He was a comedically trained actor and continues to be to this day. I mean, take anything that he does at this point, whether it's Radagast or anything else like that, and you can tell there's humor running all the way through it. But at the same time, he doesn't rely on it constantly. He wasn't quite as clowning as Troughton or something of that sort. You could tell that there was something else that he was trying to imbue the character with.
Yeah, he got very serious at times, so he put a lot of depth into his portrayal of the Doctor that, unfortunately, we just didn't get the full meaning behind it most of the time. But next week, we are going to be talking about the Eighth Doctor. We'll be talking not only about the movie, but also some of the books and audio dramas that are out there. Because 90 minutes of, a pseudo-pilot on Fox is not enough to judge one Doctor off of.
Yeah, precisely. Oh, and don't forget, you know, we will, because it is part of canon, we definitely want to make sure that we include Night of the Doctor.
Oh, absolutely.
So that'll be in that run as well.
Yeah. So we do have a little bit of news that came out this week. Unfortunately, things are slowing down. It's hitting that low point in the roller coaster that we go through. But we did get actually some footage of, well, someone basically took like a cell phone footage of some of the recording for Series 8. And it... Mm-hmm. This isn't really too much of a spoiler, but it looks like the Doctor fencing with the Robin Hood character.
Right. And we're just going to continue to refer to him as the Robin Hood character.
Yeah, until we get something set. but it almost looks like he pulls like a spoon out of his pocket or something. I can't tell what it is, but
that'll be awesome.
It'll be fun to see where this goes, though, because he looks like he's completely set for a duel and then pulls some tiny little something out of his pocket. So,
and as we've learned, you know, how appropriate that we've been talking about McCoy tonight. If you reach into your pocket and you pull out a strange object, it's probably going to be either a tribute to either Troughton, Baker, or McCoy.
Yeah.
Because they were the ones that had the pockets of randomness.
Yeah. And I mean, McCoy has come out and said before, he's like, you can tell by how full my pockets are where the scene was shot in the day. Cause he said he would fill his pockets at the beginning of the day and randomly just pull stuff out so that by the end of the filming day, his pockets were empty.
It's like, you know, that must mean it's time to go home.
Yeah, exactly. So, but speaking of the Robin Hood character, Tom Riley has come forward and said that Capaldi, quote, will completely revitalize, end quote. So he has a lot of faith in Capaldi as the Doctor.
I would hope that he's going to say some positive things. but it's an interesting choice of words. It's probably, you know, not to read too much into it, but we always do. To revitalize something means you're trying to bring something back that's half dead, and the show's certainly not, you know, anything but.
Yeah.
But if it's something where what he's really trying to imply is that it's going to be, you know, reinventing the program to a certain degree or taking it in a new direction, well, that's got to be expected. You're dealing with someone who's now, you know, 30 plus years the elder of our previous title role actor. So I'm hoping we're going to get something very, very different out of it and the chemistry that's created.
Yeah. But I mean, it's nice to hear something saying he's not trying to emulate Matt Smith. He's becoming his own Doctor. Cause I mean, that's what we all want at this point. We don't want to see, you know, the Doctor as portrayed by Matt Smith played by Peter Capaldi. You know, that's not what we want at this point. We want to see him in his portrayal. So we'll see what happens, but it's nice to get some of those words of encouragement. Mm-hmm. But speaking of Matt Smith, he has actually been confirmed as part of the cast of the new Terminator movie.
Movies.
Well, yes, movies. It's basically saying that the first movie that he's going to be in, he's going to, not a bit part, but a smaller character that will then become a much more important character over the next two subsequent films. Yes. So
of course, you know, if you're going to have time traveling robots.
It makes sense. Well.
Sure.
I mean, hell, that was one of my complaints with the Mass Effect game the whole time. I was like, okay, if London is getting destroyed by aliens, I know this is fake because the Doctor would be there to stop it. So now we've got that. You know, the Terminators understand that. They're like, the Doctor has to show up.
They've been planning for it all along.
Exactly. So,
but I know he actually, Smith had just made an appearance at, which con was he at? I want to say it's Minneapolis's con. Which was kind of cool. They had a lot of people. We've got a lot of connections up there. So we had a number of people that were sending us the photos back that he's really working. And it was hitting right around the same time this announcement was being made. So I'm sure the panels were alight with all kinds of crossover questions and such.
That's cool. I didn't realize this. I was reading through the article, and apparently Emilia Clarke, Daenerys from Game of Thrones, is going to be mm-hmm. Sarah Connor.
Ooh. Okay.
Not Linda Hamilton, but an interesting turn.
It's funny because Lena Headey,
yeah,
her co-star.
I was going to say that's two Game of Thrones stars now that have played Sarah Connor. yeah. Okay. Off the rails, but.
Collect the set, kids.
Next year, Tyrion Lannister as. I'd like to see Peter Dinklage pull off Sarah Connor. I think he could do it.
Really, I want to see him as like the T-2000 and a half.
Oh, too soon, dude. Too soon.
Oh, man.
Then the non-news of the week. So Billy Piper, who, you know, what was it, last year had said that she was completely done with Doctor Who and never wanted to touch it again. You know, then
sure.
Obviously she was convinced to join the 50th special and, you know, did her part in that and really enjoyed it and was really vocal about it. So that's cool. Apparently now she's saying she's open to the idea of doing a spinoff with Rose and Handy Doctor.
Yeah. She's basically soliciting writers.
Yeah. I saw this and I just had to laugh. I was like, really? of all the shows that the BBC can do, I doubt this is one that they're going to look at too hard.
Oh, God. It's got to be a sitcom. It's got to be a
It's a handy doctor.
The first episode, we see them like walk out of the bar from Coupling or something. I saw the headline and I was like, what? I can't believe that she's done such a complete 180 on this. It's very Tom Baker of her.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny, when you think that you can survive on your own without something and you kind of, you know, push yourself along, they bring you back for some little mention. Okay. She's in there for her moment, pun intended. And then all of a sudden, well, goodness gracious, doesn't this limelight feel nice and warm on my skin again? So I'd find a number of other ways.
I find it interesting that it took her moving to America to realize that she was okay with this. It's, yeah, apparently things aren't going too well for her here. Anyway.
Yeah. So that news will travel nowhere, and we'll move on to next week. So, as Jay mentioned, we'll go into our discussion of Paul McGann for next week. McGann and his role as our eighth doctor. Mm-hmm. In interest of continuity, we should mention that we are not going to be including John Hurt in this discussion.
No,
we're going to. No. You talk about having a limited amount of material to be able to go on. So there you go.
But I mean, there is a lot of extra work out there that includes the Eighth Doctor, both audio dramas and novelization. So if you guys have come across something like that that you feel is crucial to understanding the character of the Eighth Doctor, please let us know, because we haven't made it through all of it. There's a lot. And yeah, we want
well, crucial understanding or expanded, an increased appreciation.
There you go. Yeah.
Since, you know, if you're only getting as much as you had from the from that, you know, U.S. backdoor pilot, and said, all right, well, there was something to him that was entertaining, but it was just, you know, the script wasn't what it should be, or the effects weren't what it should be, or just it was too American, or whatever you want to hang on that. But a lot of people could tell, well, God, if the guy had gotten a fair shake. Well, if you go out and grab some of this additional material, you can see what they really wanted to do, or what they have approved to be extensions to the Eighth Doctor's stories. And you, if there are ones that really caught your attention, please let us know, because there's a lot. He's been busy.
Oh, yeah.
Busier than you realize.
Yeah, absolutely. So let us know what you've come across. We'll definitely include it in the list. But this has been episode 85 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, somewhere there's danger, somewhere there's injustice, and somewhere else, the tea is getting cold.
And this is Gear saying, you know, it all depends on who you are and how you look at it. It's strange business time.
And this is Haley saying, blowing up the art room was a creative act.
Nice call.
We'll see you next week.
I love you.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.